I know. So far.
Good morning. I'm opening this hearing of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today is February 11th. We're continuing public hearings, opening the hearing on House Bill 5026, Department of Human Services. This is a very full agenda planned for today with updates basically from four sets of people on four related but distinct topics. Ms. Byerly, would you begin by just quickly describing what we need to get through today.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, as the Chair said, there's four different topics before you today. These all relate to interim work done by the department. Most of them come out of budget notes from the 2013 session that we're reporting back on. Just as far as process, what you'll be doing today is listening about the reports. We will have you take action on accepting the reports later sometime in our DHS array of meetings. We will have
future meeting, not today,
and we will have more reports probably. We may try to do this all in one meeting to kind of get those wrapped up. I wanted to point out one thing that the Chair noticed. The very last item is the ready for work registry, not the read for work, although reading is important in work. So,
to be read, be ready.
All right. We're going to start with what is listed first on the agenda, the update on selected activities. Mr. McCormick.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike McCormick, and I'm the director of the Aging and People with Disabilities Program within the Department of Human Services. Thank you for having us here this morning. I'm here to provide an update on what's referred to as the Community-Based Care Capacity Index. So a quick background for our new members who aren't familiar with this topic. This was one of the recommended items for funding contained in the Special Purpose Appropriation for Seniors. And the vision around this funding request from the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities was to make available information on all community-based care settings available to all Oregonians. And it incorporated complex components of implementing a customer satisfaction component and vacancy. And that those two requirements increased the complexity of this project significantly. So in December, the department prepared a plan to implement this initiative with a fiscal impact of $414,000. The request was denied, and the legislature asked the department to go back and develop an alternate plan. So that is why I'm here today. So I have worked with the campaign on this recommendation. And at this point, the department already has a plan to transition all of our foster home licensing activities into a system called Aspen. This is not a new system, it's an existing system, and it's already used for licensing of foster homes that serve individuals with developmental disabilities. APD would like to move our existing licensing activities into that database, and then at the completion of that activity, we will interface those records into our ADRC webpage. This is also not a new activity, and we believe that we can complete both of these tasks by the end of the year, and then we intend to engage in a richer dialogue with the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disabilities about desired next steps. So at this point, the department is not requesting any funding to implement this initiative. We're seeking acknowledgement of the receipt of the report and approval of this plan.
Thank you. And I would like to clarify something for anyone who might be listening. You referred to something that we all call the campaign. We're not talking about an electoral or election type activity. It's a campaign is the name of a group, an advocacy organization, if you will.
Correct, co-chair.
Thank you. Are there questions about this activity? Okay, let's move on, since we have such a full agenda. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nathan Singer. I'm the Deputy Chief Operating Officer for Aging People with Disabilities within the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to provide an update around the Caregiver Training Initiative, which was funded through the 2014 legislative session special purpose appropriation for seniors. This was, just for background, a one-time funding related to training directed towards caregivers in Oregon that is to be done for both paid and unpaid caregivers statewide. The department, under the direction of the legislature, went out for procurement and contracted with Oregon Care Partners LLC to provide this training. The department worked with Oregon Care Partners LLC to create training modules to cover the initiatives that were identified through the legislature. These are training modules that go over topics such as geriatric medication management and competency, Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, training related to challenging behaviors in non-dementia populations, and special training for public safety workers related to Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. Training began this last fall with training pilots, and modules have continued throughout this period. The official kickoff happened last month. As of the end of December, 331 caregivers had been trained. 63% of those were paid caregivers, 24% were unpaid caregivers, and 61% of counties in Oregon have had at least one caregiver trained at this point. Training is expected to continue through the end of the biennium. The letter that was provided to this committee provides a fuller update as well as contact information to find out details about training in your area.
Thank you. And I have one follow-up. Oregon has, for many years, placed a high value on helping people stay in their own homes as long as they can and they or their families want to help them do that. It seems that this is an important element in us maintaining that value. Is this primarily about giving care in your own home?
Absolutely. Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, that's one of the great aspects and one things we really appreciate about this initiative and this opportunity. It's the fact that we can reach out to family members, those unpaid caregivers that are one of the strongest points in our system, and our paid caregivers that allow people to stay in their own homes and in the settings and be able to provide training around these difficult areas.
Thank you. I wanted to underscore that point.
Madam Co-Chair,
yes.
Just to follow up on your question, what percentage of those trained actually are those that are remaining in their own home versus those that may be in foster care or for other kinds of settings?
Senator Winters, co-chairs, members of the committee, I'll have to get back to you with the specifics on that information. We do have data related to the types of providers that are being trained or caregivers that are being trained. We may not have all the specifics around the locations that they're doing, as a provider may provide care in multiple locations, but I'll be able to provide further information to this committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ashley Carson Cottingham, the Deputy Director for Aging and People with Disabilities at the Department of Human Services. Based upon the direction provided by the legislature, the department worked through our Long-Term Care Quality Steering Committee to develop an application and expedited process to award funds via the Quality Fund. Excuse me. They made recommendations around projects to Mike McCormick, our director, and as a result, the department has funded 7 projects to date. The projects selected will reach all of the various types of APD license settings, and I'll just highlight quickly a couple of the projects for you right now. The first is a project led by the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. And the steering committee, the long-term care quality steering committee, discussed the issue of urinary tract infections in long-term care settings. And therefore, the Oregon Patient Safety Commission wanted to attempt to address the problem. And so their pilot is designed to teach catheter stewardship, care and maintenance of urinary devices, hand hygiene compliance, surveillance and reporting of urinary tract infections and catheter-associated urinary tract infections. And the second project I want to highlight briefly is something that I mentioned yesterday. And this is an issue that has come up where we need to have a tool or an algorithm to help us with better assess staffing in long-term care settings. And so our Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight has worked to put out an RFP, and we'll be selecting a contractor that will help create this tool to better assess whether staffing and facilities is truly meeting the needs of the residents. At the end of the projects, the Long-Term Care Quality Steering Committee will be conducting evaluation of the projects. Some of them are just getting started, and we don't have a lot of data to share today, but we hope to be able to share that in the future. And then lastly, over the past several months, we've worked to formalize, do a charter for the Long-Term Care Quality Steering Committee, and come up with a more formal process for awarding funds in the future. And we'll be using data and research to inform recommendations through the Quality Steering Committee. Those recommendations will go over to a separate fund board. And then the decision will ultimately, again, rest with Mike McCormick to fund projects moving forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Madam Co-Chair, for all three reports, the department respectfully requests acknowledgement of receipt of these reports.
And we will be doing that at a future meeting. Thank you. Your request is noted on the record.
Chair Bates and Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erica Miller. I'm a program manager with the Department of Human Services, Aging and People with Disabilities, Collaborative Disability Determination Unit. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about the General Assistance Study. I believe you've all received a copy of the report in our transmittal letter, and we'd like to request acknowledgement of receipt of the report. Prior to discussing the report, I'd like to acknowledge that some of you may not have any history with general assistance. So I'd like to provide a quick background on the general assistance program in Oregon. It's often referred to as GA. The department's general assistance program ended in 2003. It was refunded briefly and then ended again in 2005. In its final iterations, it served adults with severe disabilities without minor children in the home. The clients, as a condition of eligibility, were required to pursue Social Security benefits. The GA program provided a medical assistance benefit through the Oregon Health Plan PRESS program, a cash benefit of $314 a month, and professional level assistance with the SSA application and appeals process. Once clients were awarded SSI benefits, which could take months, 2 years, the department was reimbursed for all or a portion of that cash assistance that the client received. When the program ended, clients were transitioned to a different medical program and their cash benefits ceased. And this brings us to today's presentation. During the 2014 session, as part of APD's special purpose appropriations, the general assistance study was funded. The department entered into an intergovernmental agreement with Portland State University's Regional Research Institute on Human Services to conduct this study for us. And the study began in June of last year, and it concluded in January with the submission of their report. Karen Solarius is here with me today from PSU, as well as John Mullen, who played the role of lead stakeholder during this study. If there are no questions, I will pass it over to Karen to tell you about the study and the study findings.
Let's hear about the study.
Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Karen Solarius, and I work for the Portland State University Regional Research Institute for Human Services, which is part of the School of Social Work. And I was one of the co-investigators for this study. And we were asked three questions for this study. What already exists in Oregon and other states related to general assistance funds? What is the need today? and what potential program structures and funding options might address the needs of the target population while also addressing any barriers from past programs. So as part of the study, we spoke with over 100 people in 11 Oregon counties and 7 other states. And we conducted in-person private interviews with childless adults with disabilities that were severe enough to make them unable to work. And we also had telephone interviews and discussions with key informants in multiple fields, disabilities, physical and mental health care, employment, corrections, and veterans affairs. And we also talked with other researchers who've conducted general assistance studies and administrators from multiple states, including Utah, Washington, Nevada, and Vermont. So we concluded the study in January, and we had the following findings, which are also in the report that was submitted to you. First, federal disability benefits are available, but the rigorous and lengthy application process makes them hard to get. And childless adults with severe disabilities have multiple needs that makes it more difficult for them to go through the process on their own. And also, these disabilities and needs can be hidden, sort of not visible to just the person sort of who sees them on the street. And these disabilities can include chronic pain, degenerative spine and disc issues, traumatic brain injury, arthritis, epilepsy, PTSD, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia. All of these disabilities can be so severe that people are unable to work due to them. So resources to meet even the most basic human needs of this population are limited, especially in the area of housing. Housing is available, but it does not meet the need. So states can provide temporary disability benefits and be reimbursed, as Erica said, for them once the federal benefits are awarded. The study also found that administrative costs for such a program could be minimized by utilizing existing staff and local programs. And as there was a study that was conducted for Utah's Housing First model, which found that administrative costs of such a program would be offset by savings in healthcare, homeless assistance, and public safety. So I think I will leave it at that and turn it over to John Mullen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I want to begin with a couple of words of thanks. First, an embarrassing thanks to Representative Stark, who noticed that the information that we supplied for the committee has an interesting typo in the banner. Instead of saying most vulnerable, it says must vulnerable. Maybe there's a sort of a hidden message in this about the must part of it. But I want to acknowledge the fact that the legislature, really want to thank the legislature for funding this program. People like Senator Bates and Senator Winters have been around for a number of years. Remember that general assistance was always on the chopping block because it was general fund unmatched, even though we got a return from once the people got eligible for SSI or SSDI. Other members of the committee have a history with this, more recent, and then also Representative Olson and Representative Boone on the Human Services Committee back in 2007. So every year since the program has been defunded, I never say the program has ended, it's been defunded. Ever since it's been defunded, advocates have been back talking about what the need is and our interest in going forward. So the report is really important. One of the things that I think is important to also remember is that how things have changed since 2005. we have people that have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan, and sometimes there's an incomplete kind of process for their veterans benefits, or they may not be eligible, or there may be a need for temporary assistance, all of those things. We also have had the Great Recession, and we're still recovering from it. And I think importantly for some of the reforms that a number of you have been involved in, the public safety reforms that we've been talking about, the mental health issues that we've been talking about, and healthcare transformation. We have coordinated care organizations that have these folks in their charge. They're charged with person-centered care, and these people oftentimes don't have a place to live, and they don't have a means of sustaining themselves. And so we wind up churning these folks through homeless shelters, through local jails. We also see these are folks that we see every place in the community or all around the state. I want to also just point out a couple of things that I think are important. And begin with the study itself, and you know how we say we can't judge a book by the cover, but we actually had quite an interesting discussion about what cover to put on this. Representative Olson has always referred to this as the GAP program, recognizing the double entendre of not only the acronym, but the fact that we have a gap in our system with not funding this. Patty Whitney Wise has often talked about it. We need a bridge program to help people get to self-sufficiency, to get to the benefits that they need. The covered bridge also symbolizes the fact that these the people that are in this situation are all around the state. This is what the report shows, and we went around the state to talk to any number of people. So what our advocates have said repeatedly is that the need has not gone away, even though the funding has gone away. We think that this is now the appropriate time to move from where we've been to the study results, and then say, how can we make a smart investment that works for a relatively small number of people, a modest program, and that will be the basis for House Bill 2194, which will be heard, we hope, in next month or so in Housing and Human Services. Representative Kenny Geyer as the chair of that committee. Ultimately, of course, we hope this issue is coming back to you for consideration about funding. The final thing that I'd like to say is, again, some thanks. I want to really acknowledge the Department of Human Services, and particularly Erica Miller, who was a terrific resource all throughout this. Karen and her team at Portland State University did a really terrific job with a relatively modest amount of money. I also want to thank my General Assistant Steering Committee, people that I've worked with that we've kept the pilot light on for all of these years, hoping that we'll have an opportunity to have this kind of discussion with the Ways and Means Committee when it comes to time to look at potential for funding. But again, I'm very pleased with the study, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. If we can provide any additional information or you have any questions about the study itself, we'd be happy to answer what we can today or get back to you if you have thoughts later on. Thank you very much.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Karen, a couple quick questions. You may not have any answers to any of these. How much, considering what's gone on in the Great Recession, what people have gone through, how fast is this population growing?
Yeah. How fast is the population growing, Senator Bates? So when looking at records of the presumptive Medicaid population that is served by DHS currently, it looks like it's pretty much flatlined. It hasn't really grown that much, so they expect that the need will be sort of similar to before, and that's simply because this is a population that people are constantly rotating off of once they get federal disability benefits.
May I comment as well, Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
Senator Bates, one of the things that I know that you're fully aware of and other members may be aware of as well is that the presumptive caseload is a sort of now a snapshot in time, because now people get eligibility not by saying, how the disabling conditions they have, but how poor they are. So we really have converted that discussion. So we have this snapshot of a window of time of the presumptive caseload, and within that caseload, what the pilot would be looking at is about 200 people that have been identified as homeless, as being having the most severe need. We think there are more than that that are homeless that certainly meet the HUD definition of homeless, but we're talking about the people that are out in the street and have no place to go. So whether the population is changing or not is really hard to say, because the presumptive caseload will become an artifact of the past after a bit of time. But we will see people, we continue to see people in all areas of the state that are experiencing severe physical disabilities and oftentimes severe mental disabilities as well. I don't know of anything that has looked at that population here in the state to sort of forecast, is it growing or changing or around the country? And I don't know if Erica or Karen have any additional information, but just want to make that comment about how the nature of us understanding the population is changing a little bit as we convert to MAGI eligibility.
Hello.
Yes.
I think you're looking at one snapshot in time, and I understand that. If you look nationally at what's happening, there's a number of people going into disability since the Great Recession.
Yes.
It's a 45-degree angle. I mean, it's huge.
That's right.
And I don't know if you have an answer to this one, Karen, or not. There is concerns at the trust fund for disabilities, for people who are disabled and receiving support from the federal government, is going to run out of money in 2 or 3 years. Was that looked at all? Did you ever have a discussion about that? It's out of our realm. I mean, it's federal monies, but if that's not in some way funded by the federal government, these people are going to probably fall back in our laps, is my concern. What did you discover during the study? Was there any discussion about that?
Looking at that federal possibility was beyond the scope of the study, but the state currently is the department that determines presumptive eligibility for that. So if you tie this program with that, the people that are already determined by the state to be probably eligible for federal benefits, then it just depends on how you decide to structure the program.
My concern is that the funding goes away at the federal level, or it's reduced, and so most of these people get $600-$700 a month, or maybe a little more or less than that. And the federal government, if that's reduced by a couple hundred dollars, they're not going to be able to live in any kind of housing we have. They're going to be out in the streets again. And that is a huge part, not just the part you're moving through. That's a huge population. So I don't know how many people in Oregon are receiving federal benefits under disability. I'm worried about them coming back to us in 2, 3, or 4 years if the federal government doesn't act.
If I might, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Bates, I think that's an excellent point. I have been monitoring that discussion at the federal level, and we did have a little bit of discussion about that and reviewed a number of reports, but what Congress will do in the future is really hard to know. And meanwhile, I think that hopefully the pilot consideration, if we can get people in that system, assuming that it's going to be there, because I can in my wildest dreams imagine that disability would be done away with, but there's a possibility that it may be trimmed because of the way they are looking at the two trust funds with Social Security and the Disability Trust Fund. So that's an excellent point. We'll keep our eye on that, and of course we don't make decisions at the federal level. Sometimes I wish some of you were there to make those decisions, but
we wouldn't be nearly as effective if we were there.
We have questions from Representative Boone, followed by
in such a minority.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was trying to look something up, and I'll have to go. I was in the big study for a big report, so I'm trying to get a picture of it. I sort of remember back in those days, John, but not a lot. And so basically, you serve people who just with disabilities, just without children. Is that?
Would you care to answer that question?
Yes, Representative Boone, members of the committee, that's correct. As it's written in the report, this program would serve individuals without minor children in the home who have severe disabilities.
Okay, just a quick follow-up. And I did hear the word veterans in there in your topical cover, but wondered how, I guess a couple of questions, and how people, how you find them or they find you, and then how do you connect them with their veterans benefits if they're qualified for them?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Boone, we did have the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs involved with the study, along with the Oregon Housing Community Services, the Department of Corrections, and the question is really a good one. When I was director in Clackamas County Social Services, we had the Veterans Service Office there, so we could make those connections with people, and it was always one of the first questions we asked about veteran status and try to hook people up with better benefits. There is an interesting wrinkle about veterans issues that we would love to be able to have a program that also fronted the opportunity for people to get assistance that are waiting for veterans benefits. And we've talked with Cameron Smith about that. It would require probably a change in federal law to make that happen. But it's really, I think, telling that we do wind up having a number of veterans that are homeless and in need of assistance. And by having case management assistance that can help to take a look at what's happening with that particular person, appropriate referrals may be made to County Veterans Services Office, because getting veterans benefits often is a better situation for people than even getting disability benefits from SSI or SSDI.
Just a quick comment on that, too. In the veterans world, they're trying very hard to get the other state agencies and other local services around that and asking that question, are you a veteran? It's so easy to ask, and then if they are, they go this path. Mm-hmm. And we are still not serving all the veterans in Oregon, and there's a lot of federal money that comes to them directly that could really make a change in this whole picture.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Boone, the one thing that people told us in the study is if you serve, especially if you target people who are homeless, that there are veterans in that population, and they tend to be the veterans that are the least connected with the VA, and so that even if you don't target this program specifically towards veterans would definitely benefit from this.
Representative Storm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick disclaimers before I ask my question is I apologize. I had to step out for a brief moment during your presentation, Karen. So if you already answered this, just bear with me, if you will. And the second is, this might be a question that you share later or an answer that you share later with House Bill 2194, as you referenced, but just to know that it's upcoming. You mentioned, John, that in your that when this program was defunded, the program didn't go away. And so I'm curious, how did the operations expenses get paid during that? Oh. And would also be interested in seeing at some point what services were provided when it was funded, when the funding went away, and then if it's funded again, you know, what's the true comparison of what is and isn't done during that?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Stark. If I didn't say this correctly, what I meant to say is that while the funding went away, the need didn't go away. What happened in Clackamas County, though, was interesting, because we were able to secure a grant from the Social Security Administration to do case management to help people. We didn't have any cash assistance for those folks, and we wound up focusing on people who were in county jails for reasons that were for minor infractions, people that were simply poor and had no place to go, and were involved in such minor infractions like public urination, and they got arrested and wound up in jail. And we helped to connect those people with benefits. But when our grant from Social Security went away, then we just didn't have the funding available to continue doing the work. So it is. There's a hodgepodge of a variety of organizations that do some work in this arena, but and, you know, the work that was done in the General Assistance Program, when we had the whole array of services from healthcare to cash assistance to helping people get the disability benefits, we have not had that since 2005.
Okay. So, just to clarify, so for your purposes of what you intended the program to do, when the funding went away, that did stop?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, I'm kind of trying to remember on this. I think it just makes sense to call it GAP rather than GA. But were we kind of in the ballpark? We were always talking somewhere, it seems like, about $2 to $3 million.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Olson, the way in which we calculate the cost of this is a little tricky, and when we have an official estimate, it will come down to you here when you have a chance to take a look at it. We had estimated about, for our pilot, about $1.6 million for this number of people, but that's a net cost, because one of the things that's always an issue when we look at general assistance is that we actually front the service money, and we don't get a return on it until after the person gets disability benefits. So it may be in the next biennium we have that recovery. So it's always a tricky thing to do the estimate. We look forward to having the hearing about our bill and then getting an official estimate of cost.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Bates.
Gary, back to you again on that same issue. This is basically a revolving fund for the most part. And I assume some people get turned down, but most people probably, in fact, end up getting disability payments. In my personal experience, I find the people who are least disabled are the most likely to get it, because the people who are really seriously disabled, mentally or otherwise, really have a hard time getting the paperwork done. They can't afford an attorney. They are living out in the street, and they kind of give up. So the program really is important for those people. All that said, what kind of money would it take? Did you have a chance to look at what that revolving fund would be? If we set up a revolving fund, funded the first time around, money came in from the feds for the next biennium or their maybe even 3 years, 4 years, what kind of money are we talking about here?
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Bates, the report does contain some information about past costs and future costs, and we looked primarily at the cost of a potential pilot program for this study. However, there is some information in here about costs. And yes, it's true, most of the funds would come back. Those would be the funds that are provided as housing or temporary cash assistance. And it's just the administrative costs that are not reimbursed. But as we said in the report, those costs could be reduced by using existing staff, because the state already does the disability determination for the feds, and also that there will be cost offsets from savings in like ambulance calls and emergency room visits, and quite a few people that would qualify for this program rotate in and out of the jails and prisons, and so there'll be reduction in costs for that.
Senator Winters.
Yeah, how much, in looking at the some of the processes inside of the program, in addition to the revolving fund, would the responsibility of coordinating with other agencies, because as we talk about the broad range and as we look at funding and as we sit here and say we're going to make certain on the veteran side, for example, that there are certain other additional dollars that may take place that could be actually utilized for what you're doing, the same is true when we look at some of the other elements that we all get involved with. So does your report in looking ahead for a pilot take those kinds of things into consideration? And I'm going to go back to what you said, John, and the question that was asked by Representative Boone, and where you find a veteran who could or should be accessing certain services, but because of whatever reason has not. So is that considered as we go forward?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Winters, that's a really an excellent question, and one of the reasons why case management, I'm a big believer in case management and having people that are trained and understand not only about the issues that people face, but also understanding community resources. We have only a small amount of money to go around to help people, and if we don't work in the same direction to help people, then we're really creating a difficulty for ourselves in sustaining programs. So I'm a firm believer that case managers working in this program in the pilot would need to be working with community resources about finding appropriate and affordable housing, about making sure that they're connected to their CCO, if they have mental health issues, that they're getting in for their mental health visits, that they're on medication. All of these things that that are potentially wraparound services for people are existing services, and it's existing systems that are already serving these people, but sometimes ineffectively.
Well, I guess my question is follow-up. My question is whether that'll be a part of this, the gap funding, because I agree. We add on without talking about how we're going to take what's existing and make it work. So case management, to me, is very critical, you know, for this as well as other initiatives that we began. So
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Winters, I would simply say I absolutely agree. I just think that's the model that we have in mind.
I'm reflecting on the comment that Mr. Mullen made a while ago. There is a bill to propose doing something about this. The bill will be heard in a policy committee mm-hmm. that one of our members chairs. I presume a hearing is going to be scheduled.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. So if the bill is successful in a policy committee, then we will have the opportunity to study this in depth again. I would like to ask a question about one aspect of the report, since what we're doing right now is considering the report that you all completed. One of the specific populations that's mentioned is people released from the state hospital and now under the supervision of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. We've been concerned about this population for several years due to the lack of appropriate types of housing. I mean, it not just programmatically, but housing. Are there any other efforts that you are aware of to either construct or repurpose housing for this specific population?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, housing is such a challenge on so many different issues. It cuts across every human service population. What we are hoping to do in this, the pilot idea that we have, is to have, rather than cash assistance, the way general assistance worked in the past, is to actually provide housing along a housing first model. So it would be working with community partners to find the most appropriate and affordable housing in the community. We work with Housing and Community Services to look at housing costs around the state and then came up with the way in which we would make that happen. But frankly, that's going to be a challenge because there isn't, to answer your question directly, there isn't many types of housing that exist just for that. A program that I worked on in Clackamas County converted an apartment building to single-room occupancy that served individual people, but it was 8 units, and we had lots and lots of waiting lists for that. So to answer your question, there's not any set housing sort of scenario that exists, and we're going to have to make do with what's out there.
John, if I might add, Madam Co-Chair, the pilot program that they propose, so the Housing First model would be to have cash assistance for housing, but it would be paid directly to the landlord or the renter. And so it could be a sort of a sliding scale fee depending on what the cost of the housing is with a certain maximum that you wouldn't go over. And then, but this model lets people who are in danger of losing their housing potentially stay in their housing. So if they have a relative who might have a room for them but can't accommodate them, then this is a way that person could actually stay with that relative. And so, and it in no way would pay for, you know, housing that's already available. It's just if people are in danger of losing their housing, as well as people who are currently experiencing homelessness.
Thank you. Representative Penny Dyer.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment that this was such a compelling case for the study last time around. You had people who had come in and were disabled because of car accidents and then lost their job, didn't have money for housing, ended up on the street, ends up costing everyone a lot more money. So, you know, I have some frustration that it's only a pilot that we're looking at and not fully funding what we know saves a lot of money. But I think the opportunity for a pilot gives us the opportunity to see, you know, how do we support this on a long-term basis with the amount of money that's really needed. And the big change in the landscape is the CCOs. And the CCOs, you know, really should be doing a lot of this kind of case management for the same population. And so how, in your pilot, can you look at how can you scale this up by really making connections with CCOs? Perhaps CCOs should be thinking about a revolving loan fund. So that's what I hope that this pilot will give us the opportunity to do, is how do we fully sustain this program in our new landscape? And I'm looking forward to talking about that more in the Human Services Committee.
Thank you.
Good. We're going to wrap this up in just a minute or so, because we do have two more substantive topics and Senator Bates can't stay with us for the whole meeting. Did you have a real
partially,
quick follow-up?
Representative Kenny Geyer brought up the issue I've got, and that's the CCOs, whether or not involved in this. Would seem appropriate. First, I don't know why you're doing a pilot. It should be done statewide. Okay. Secondly, I don't know what it costs to set that first fund up so it's a revolving fund, but it seems like that's something we should do. Mm-hmm. The question is, who manages that? Every time one of these people who, my understanding is, when you're in this process of trying to get disability, while you're in that process, you're in a Medicaid program, and for the first 2 years you get your disability, you're still in a Medicaid program because Medicare doesn't kick in roughly 2 years later. So you're talking about a 3 or 4 year period of time when these people are going to be inside CCOs.
Right.
Each hospitalization is probably anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 to $20,000 anytime one of these people go to the hospital, which could be avoided with the right program. So your relating clause, is it wide enough to bring the CCOs in?
It looks like we are preparing the panel for all the questions that are going to be raised at the public hearing on the bill, which is at a later date. Good.
Are we talking to Representative Kenny Geyer at a later time?
Right. Yes, I'm with you, Senator. Plenty of advance notice.
I'm completely with you, Senator.
I would like to wrap this up.
Can I just add one quickie, just
yes.
a comment? I'm concerned about adding to the CCO's workload by including housing issues involved with that, because, again, they're not all one size fits all. I have no problem with coordinating with them or having them ask the question, are you a veteran, do you have housing, what, those kinds of things. But I'm very concerned about adding another component to their workload.
Thank you for that comment. Yeah. Thank you for the presentation. We're obviously looking forward to discussing it some more with you. The next topic on the agenda is the wage report. Let's start that quickly.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, for this item, there's both an actual narrative report in your OLIS materials as well as this presentation document.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Moore. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services. I'd like to start by saying that this is the first time we've attempted to collect this type of detailed data from these providers across service systems, and it was quite an undertaking on both sides. We would like to thank the over 2,000 providers who responded, as this occurred during a time of great program change, and we appreciate their willingness to participate in these surveys. We saw the intent of this budget report as looking at wages for services which utilize direct care workers in which we did not directly bargain their wages. For the report, the providers we used, we set the payment rate, which may include a wage calculation for direct care workers and other positions, but we do not mandate or set the wage for direct care workers as part of this process. We did not therefore include providers that that the state directly collectively bargains wages with for the wages related to direct care workers. There are providers, mostly nursing facilities, that do bargain wages, but the state is not involved in those bargainings. We collected this information due to the budget note in House Bill 5029 from 2013. From this budget note, the report sets out five domains of information that are included in the presentation today. These domains are the profile of long-term care providers, their service users and direct care workers, wages, inflation, and Medicaid rates, fringe benefits, turnover, and options for ensuring that funding increases translate into wage increases. DHS ultimately awarded the contract to RTI International, a firm that specializes in research and analysis for the public and private sectors. They're here today to present their findings, including included in your materials is their summary report with their full report that's available online, and that's about a 220-page report that's available online that we provided a link to in the executive summary. With us here is a member of RTI, Sarah Zuckerbraun, who has put in many hours of effort into the research being presented today at a very high level. Just a couple of points. It's difficult to obtain accurate 2003-05 wage information retrospectively using a survey of 2014 providers. Some providers in 2014 did not exist in 2003, and there was a large turnover in staff during these times. Recognizing this, another data source was on historical wages. The Bureau of Labor Statistics wage data was used for benchmarking purposes. However, the BLS data do not provide an exact apples-to-apples comparison because the duties of the staff in the BLS data are not exactly the same as the duties of the direct care workers that were the focus of the study. This is also a survey of providers in business in 2014, so if we had a company that was in business in 2003 but not in business in 2014, they were not included in the survey. In addition, the options mentioned in the budget note were essentially the main options available to the state, but each come with their own challenges and benefits. The report does, however, provide some interesting data that we hope will help legislators better understand this complex issue, especially with the level of interest in this report increasing since the budget note was created. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Zuckerbraun for the presentation.
Thank you. Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sarah Zuckerbraun, a senior research manager in RTI International. Direct care workers are the backbone of a long-term care system. Their wages and lack of fringe benefits are an ongoing concern in long-term care. There's evidence from the long-term care research that their wages and lack of fringe benefits makes recruitment and retention of staff difficult, may increase turnover, and may reduce quality of care. These issues, especially because of the heavy dependence on long-term care providers on Medicaid, are a concern to Oregon, as they are to all states. And as Eric just told you, in 2014, HB 5029 directed DHS to conduct a study to assess the status of direct care workers and to look at options for ensuring that Medicaid rates translate into wage increases. Today, we'll present the results of that study to you. The data to answer the questions in domains 1, 2, 4, which is the profile, the data to answer these questions, which Eric went over with you a moment ago, were not available publicly. So DHS, for Oregon, not available publicly. So DHS collected it through a survey. They contracted with RTI International, an independent nonprofit research organization. In consultation with DHS, RTI designed, fielded, and analyzed the Oregon Wage and Fringe Benefit Study of long-term care providers. The survey was sent to a statistical sample of all long-term care providers participating in Medicaid, except for independent providers. It was conducted in the summer of 2014. There was an 81% response rate. The figures we'll show today reflect the population of long-term care providers and direct care workers. So you'll see some numbers which are higher than 2008, which is the number of completed cases. That's because we are weighting them up to show true population numbers. Domain one is the profile of a long-term care system in Oregon. Excluding independent providers, there are 3,819 providers participating in Medicaid. That's the first bar on the left. So if you'll just take note of the next two tallest bars, they are adult foster care homes of different types. One-third do not employ any direct care workers. In all, there are 14 different types of providers. They're not all shown on this slide due to space and small cell sizes. These 3,819 providers employ an estimated 36,685 direct care workers. It's the direct care workers who provide hands-on care. They serve an estimated 45,858 individuals. Domain two. The survey found that in 2014, the mean wage of direct care workers, averaged across all workers, was $12.38 per hour. The median wage was $11.15 per hour. Looking at the second set of bars, we see that nursing facilities pay higher wages, as do adult foster care for the aged and people with physical disabilities. Removing these types of facilities from the calculation, the mean wage is $11.13, and the median wage is $10.75. So these providers definitely boost up average wages. Other providers have little variation in average wage rates. You see how the other bars are really just about the same height as each other. We looked closely at the difference in payment rates between providers, which had more than a median percentage of service users who used Medicaid to pay for their services, and providers which had less than the median percentage. Statistically controlling for all other variables, high Medicaid providers did have lower wages, but the magnitude was small. Each percentage point increase in the percent Medicaid reduced average wages by 1 cent. Thus, a 20% increase in providers' percent Medicaid population will result in a reduction in average wages by about 20 cents per hour. Relatively few long-term care providers were engaged in collective bargaining to set wages, although 28% of nursing facilities reported using collective bargaining. As for the providers reported as important factors when they were setting wages, they answered that the ones that were most important were the minimum wage, education and experience of the individual worker, wages of other long-term care providers, and wages of fast food workers was hardly mentioned, and also the Medicaid rate was also not mentioned as a top factor. Wages increased between 2003 and 2014. That's the black line, but not as much as inflation, which is the green line. The inflation-adjusted rate in 2014 would have been 11.88, and the wage that you see here in the black line from the survey is 11.10. This is not the same thing as 12.38 because this particular graph is weighted by providers. The Medicaid payment rates for this period by provider type are shown in RTI's report to DHS. Medicaid payment rates to providers increased more than wages between 2013 and 2014. They increased more slowly from 2009 to 2014 and were more in line with wage increases in that second period. The other colored lines on this graph are there for benchmarking purposes. They are the wage rates for Oregon collected by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics Occupational Employment Statistics Program. You can see that the survey data, which again is the black line, tracks closely with the BLS category in purple, which is personal care aides. In case you're wondering what that blue line on top is, that's nursing aides, and they have a significantly higher rate.
I'm going to stop you for a moment and ask a question because you are comparing wages for nursing aides to personal care aides and home health aides. I had an opportunity recently to visit a home in my district, and I noted that the persons working there were providing medication management. They were administering medications. They had responsibilities to take care of, for example, minor injuries, to assist with other daily activities. Are those some of what a nursing aide would do also? How do the duties compare?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Nathan Singer. I'm the Deputy Chief Operating Officer for Aging People Disabilities. Specific to the nursing assistants here, those are talking about certified nursing assistants. Those are mandated in our nursing facility locations. They have certification under Oregon law and as well as national specifications. Many of those duties are done by certified nursing assistants. They also have additional requirements that they have to do underneath an RN for direct supervision. So comparing them, there are some differences as well as the certification differences amongst the populations. But our direct care workers in many of our locations provide similar or many of the duties that a certified nursing assistant would provide.
Okay, thanks. I don't want to sidetrack us for too long. I just wanted to understand that. Okay, please go on. We have 15 minutes to complete not only your presentation, but follow-up questions that the committee will have.
The survey also asked about many different kinds of fringe benefits, and four of them were offered more often than the others. The most commonly offered fringe benefits are paid holidays, employee-only health insurance, and personal time off. The latter two are shown on this slide. 42% of the providers offer employee-only health insurance, and 60% offer some type of paid time off. The fringe benefit offerings by providers vary greatly by type of benefit and provider type, and also vary greatly as to usage by employees when they're provided. They're offered more to full-time employees than part-time employees. About 36% of direct care workers are employed part-time. Also, benefits that require employee contributions, such as health insurance, have a much lower enrollment than benefits that are free.
Well, that's not much of a surprise.
Domain 4, employee turnover. Turnover is an indicator of quality of care. In part, turnover may be a consequence of low wages and lack of fringe benefits. There's statistical analysis on this point in our report at the end of Chapter 6. Average annual turnover was 64% among direct care workers in 2014, the survey found, with wide variation across provider types, as shown on those bars.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Do you have trend data on the turnover rate? I mean, my understanding is that it's been getting better. That's still not great. I don't like those turnover rates at all. But do you have a sense? Did your data show anything about where we were 3 years ago?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator
Steiner Hayward, but don't worry about it.
The survey was not designed to focus on the question of trends in turnover. So no, I don't have the answer to that. I have trends in wages, but not in turnover from the survey.
Okay. And did you ask any, if I may, Madam Chair, really quick, did you ask anything about reasons for turnover, or you're just hypothesizing because of the way you made some thoughts, you offered some thoughts, wages, but you didn't ask about that specifically on the survey?
The respondent to the survey was the provider organization, not the direct care workers themselves.
Ah.
So we did not ask them to speculate on the reason for their employee turnover.
Okay.
Mm.
I think we missed
what I was
budget,
yeah.
Sorry.
When I spoke about the relationship between turnover and wages, I was speaking from research studies and also from a statistical analysis that is in the back of Chapter 6 of our long report. It shows the factors that are statistically related to turnover.
Thank you. If there's time at the end of the presentation, I'll add my own comment on turnover.
Domain 5, options for ensuring that wage rates increases translate into wage increases. Many states would like to have options to increase direct care worker pay without it costing the state more money. Options are hard to come by. We focus here on wage pass-throughs where there is some evidence and research. Medicaid payment rate increases do not necessarily translate to comparable worker wage increases. However, wage pass-through legislation is an option that attempts to ensure that Medicaid increases result in wage increases. Early research on effectiveness is mixed. More recent evidence is positive. Making wage pass-through effective requires strict monitoring of providers. Providers in other states have resisted such legislation. The recourse is to, if you find out that the provider is not paying the wage, is to sue the provider in court for breach of statute or put a hold on their license, which may not be the ultimate goal as anticipated.
We have some additional options that the state wanted to be to present as part of this package. We have increasing the minimum wage. This is not a topic that DHS is able to talk on at this point. We have also preparing contractual provisions to look at making sure that wages are provided to direct care workers. Again, looking at that as an option, it may be easier to implement in some ways, but there are absolutely some administrative burdens that would be presented as trying to ensure that that occurred. We also have collective bargaining considerations to look at, as well as allowing the market to direct the wages for individuals. All these areas the department was willing to engage with this committee or any members to discuss further, but we don't have the information today.
Thank you. Next slide.
Just to summarize the main points, not including independent providers, 3,819 long-term care providers participate in the Oregon Medicaid program. In 2014, the mean wage of direct care workers weighted by the number of workers was $12.38, and the median wage was $11.15. I didn't mention this in my other slide for interest of time, but as you see, that median wage, $11.15 per hour, is just about $2 an hour higher than the Oregon median wage. While wages have increased over time, they have not kept pace with either inflation or increases in the Medicaid payment rates. Fringe benefit offerings by long-term care providers vary greatly by type of benefit and provider type. The most commonly offered fringe benefit is paid personal time off, followed by paid holidays and employee-only health insurance. Fringe benefits that require an employee make their own contribution have lower participation rates. There was some evidence in the research of fringe benefits being offered at a slightly increased rate between 2010 and 2014 among certain types of providers. The average annual turnover rate among direct care workers across all provider types was 64%, although there is wide variation across provider types. And finally, wage pass-through legislation and other options can be a successful strategy in increasing worker wages, but it requires extensive oversight.
Thank you. I'm going to comment for a moment on the question of wages and turnover. I have visited with two places now, having an opportunity to talk with DSP, direct service provider, and also parents of adults with developmental disabilities. One of the moms said absolutely the key issue is turnover, that it takes months for her child to develop a relationship and trust the caregiver, and when the turnover is every 2 to 3 months, sometimes quicker, that trust, it's really hard to establish, and sometimes you never even get there, and it ends up impacting the ability to provide appropriate care and to maintain a certain level of physical health well-being because of that. The point was to be a DSP, I'm more or less quoting, I was jotting notes as I was listening, you have to be on the entire time. It's physically and mentally draining.
They can't even take care of their own families. That's due to the long hours and the very low pay. They're responsible for medications, hygiene, behavior. The lives of human beings are in your hand. You're responsible for their world. But for this, you could get, for this, you also get screamed at, hit, kicked, spit, pinched, bitten, and worse. But for this, it's about the same pay as a Carl's Jr. job. So which would you pick after a few months of this kind of stress? So that's the kind of stories I've gotten from several people now in the last few months. How does Oregon's story compare to other states?
Madam Co-Chair, thank you for sharing that meaningful story. This is a problem that faces all the states. I can speak more specifically to how to the factors that influence turnover. They're not what you would expect. It's not as this smoking gun that it's related straight to wages. We saw, when statistically controlling for other factors, that private for-profit providers had significantly higher turnover rates of direct care workers compared to government-owned providers. I can't tell exactly the kind of provider in the story you're referring to, but it sounds like it may be a government provider, which, so, don't know, okay. Being part of a corporate chain also significantly increased turnover rates for direct care workers compared with providers who were individual entities. I'm only telling you the ones that are statistically significant here. Unexpectedly, providers that required at least 75 hours of training by their direct care workers had higher turnover rates than providers with lower training requirements. So that suggests that when workers obtain more training, they're able to move to positions elsewhere, perhaps where the pay is higher.
Okay.
The 75 hours is something we asked in the survey because it's borrowed from the federal level. That's a particular level of training, so we use that in our survey. And finally, providers that had a higher proportion of low-wage direct care workers, that is less than $12 an hour, had higher turnover rates than providers who had a lower proportion of low-wage direct care workers.
It's the correlation.
That's very useful information. I had noted one other thing. One of the providers said that they invest about $4,000 in training cost. And so it's troubling to supervisors when someone's gone through training and then leaves within a few days or a few weeks because they can't handle the strain. And part of the strain was due to the high turnover and needing to work double shifts, for example, either beyond your hours or more days in a row than you had planned because there isn't someone else available. So do you have any information on like hours worked or working how many days without a break, that sort of information?
From this survey, I don't. Madam Chairman, we could look at that information at the federal level and get back to you, but it was not part of the budget note, so we didn't ask it.
That's okay. It just interested me, though, that the issue of high turnover affected who's showing up for work, the stress on the remaining people, and it seemed like a vicious cycle. Did you have a follow-up?
I'll let you go ahead.
I'm really interested, and I understand that you probably didn't do this, but this is one of the places where I think we need better correlation between DHS and OHA, because I'm very interested, and I believe Senator Winters is as well, in the correlation between continuity of care with providers and quality of care, or reducing medical costs in general, and increasing the likelihood that someone can stay in their own home if they want to, or stay in a facility of their choice. And I don't
know exactly how, but I'm assuming that's not something you all looked into at all.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Steiner Howard, that's not something we looked into, both in the interest of being faithful to the budget note and in the interest of keeping the survey as short as possible so as not to overburden our providers who responded. However, one could look at under Medicare.gov, there is home health care, what is it called? Homehealthcarecompare.gov and nursinghomecompare.gov, where one can look up the individual name of the facility. And these collect patient-supplied ratings on how they found their quality of care. And one could look at that compared to the survey data that we have collected here and possibly look at correlation. It hasn't been done, and it's just a suggestion that we had.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senator Steiner, Hayward. Wow, I just said two. See, this is what happens.
It's okay, I cover a lot of things.
Wow, all right. Well, there we go.
Just it's my continues fault for having the longest name in the legislature. Please don't give it a second thought.
All right, thank you for that. As we looked at the information around the report and answering, and as Eric mentioned earlier in our presentation, this is something that the department hasn't gathered information around. It's an area that's extremely important. As we listened to what Co-Chair Nathanson said around direct care providers, you know, the work that our providers do is so essential, and it is difficult work. Providing care for Oregonians is extremely difficult, and ensuring that we meet health guidance and outcomes is an important area that we are looking at. Right now, we don't have the data related to that. This report stuck very specifically to the budget note, but those are areas we continue to work with the Oregon Health Authority as we look at many of our programs using our innovator agents on the long-term care side to find ways to really look at how outcomes are happening. But unfortunately, we don't have that related to this report.
Could you schedule some time to talk with me about that offline, please?
Yes.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I have a
second longest name.
Exactly. I have a comment and then a question. It seems very evident from your slides that there's a very strong correlation between higher wages, higher benefits, lower turnover, which is critically important in terms of that bonding and attachment that adults with disabilities or, you know, the elderly really need. The nursing facilities came up the highest in the wages and highest in, I think, among the highest in the benefits. The facilities for people, adults with developmental disabilities came up, I think, second highest on paid sick time, family leave, things like that. So in this legislative session, I don't know of wage pass-through legislation. I don't know if that's there. I know that you said that that takes a lot to monitor, and you'd have to weigh the costs and benefits to that. We do have other legislation pending, obviously, on the paid sick leave and raising minimum wage. But the last area that you mentioned was that 20% of the nursing facilities had collective bargaining, and that presumably has resulted in the highest wages and contributes to one of the lowest turnovers. So did you do any studies between, you know, often when some organizations have collective bargaining, that often because of competitive, you know, they're trained for similar things, that raises wages up in the other ones that may not be unionized. Did you look at that at all to look at what the impacts of collective bargaining are in that particular among nursing facilities and the difference between the 20% that have collective bargaining and the 80% that don't? Did they all have high wages across the board?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Kenny Gliver, I will find the answer to that question in this report. I think that parts of it were statistically significant and parts weren't, but we can get back to you on that answer.
Okay. Great, thank you.
Yeah, and for those of you who might be listening to the conversation and wondering, when we ask a question and additional information is going to be provided to us, it makes its way to the entire committee, and it also then becomes publicly available, just like everything you're hearing in the meeting today. So it doesn't just go to one individual person. Everybody will be able to see, read or hear the answers to the questions. Thank you. We have a choice now. We can wrap this up and handle our last agenda item in 10 minutes, or we can continue this discussion. You want to try to finish our agenda today?
I'm fine with that, Madam Chair.
Good. Thank you so much for coming to present to us today.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to your follow-up responses. Come on down.
I'm getting used to this. I'm not quite sure I was getting used to this.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Frank Sardinia-Miles, background check unit manager for the Department of Human Services. Just to give a quick update in terms of the origin of this budget note, House Bill 4151, Section 6 from the 2014 session requested that DHS augment the department's criminal background check system with a regularly updated registry of all persons who work or seek to work in the facilities or roles assigned by the bill. To be to the point, the registry became operational at the beginning of January 2015. As of the end of January, 4,000 people had been listed on the registry. 46 employers statewide were already able to utilize the registry to avoid duplicative background checks. In terms of a comprehensive ready-to-work registry, the background check unit began an assessment of the feasibility of developing a comprehensive, diverse, multi-care worker registry. The initial assessment demonstrated this would be a significant undertaking with substantial barriers. We identified 217 existing licensing and certification registries across a variety of state agencies. Each registry has existing statutes and administrative rules that affect the registry's specific licensing and certification processes. Those agencies...
Sorry, pardon? I'm just looking at these numbers, and I apologize for interrupting you. I'm just stunned by these numbers. Sorry, keep going. I apologize.
Good stunned, hopefully.
Stunned that we've got 2,500 qualified entity designees running background checks, 780 of them. I mean, the different things. Anyway, keep
and
going.
About 50 different state agencies that right. each wrote their own rules.
I know. Well, this is exactly why we passed this legislation in 2013. I mean, this is...
Okay.
Sorry, keep going. I apologize.
Thank you. Those registries, those agencies with registries also have varied stakeholders and collective bargaining agreements. Based on this initial assessment, it would take a significant cross-agency effort to first identify the stakeholders and the relevant regulations, including statutes, administrative rules, collective bargaining agreements, and policies. Once complete, a cross-agency work group would need to be convened to begin recommending changes to the regulations to facilitate the standardization needed to develop this registry. At that point, a full report could be made as to the potential efficiencies, benefits, costs, barriers, and solutions.
But you haven't made reference to the cross-agency group that is already working to address it.
Co-Chair Nathanson.
We can follow up and let the committee know how that's going.
In terms of House Bill 3168 and that update, House Bill 3168 from the 2013 session gave the Department of Administrative Services the rulemaking authority for criminal records checks. The goal of this legislation was a single set of statewide rules that would provide more uniform rules for fitness determination, most specifically around criminal history. So it may not necessarily include licensing and certification processes always, but based on the vulnerable population being served. The Department of Human Services is collaborating very closely at the moment with the Department of Administrative Services as they facilitate work groups with membership from across a multitude of agencies to write the rules. Once the rules are published, anticipated at present for fall of 2015, we expect to see a reduction in duplicative background checks as well as a decrease in waiting times for applicants and employers.
Okay. And that's very important news, the decrease in waiting time for applicants and employers, because I've heard from local organizations in my community that they have people ready to work, they have clients who need someone to help them, and they can't get the help to the client because mm-hmm. they can't get the background check finished. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm just very glad to hear of your efforts in collaborating and bringing this about. Yes, Senator Winters.
Co-chair, and he mentioned DAS. Is there somewhere we can get a report from DAS on the work that's being done, you know, jointly with agencies on the collaboration?
I'll make sure you get a report. Yes, DAS yes. has presented their update to a couple of other policy committees, and we'll get a copy of that.
Yeah, it would be nice since to brief us as well. Thank you.
Good.
Does the committee have any questions?
Representative Kenigawa.
You know, just a quick comment to thank you, Madam Chair, for your work on this. I remember it coming through the Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. I'm just somehow not finding under 2014 this particular bill. I don't know if that's...
It was 2013.
2013 was the first one, the 3618.
Then it was in the...
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Kenigawa, it's 31. It's 3168, the number on that slide is I think, a typo.
And then the 4151 was, I couldn't find it either. The 4151 that I found from last year was actually Hoyle and Gilliam's elder abuse.
That was part of it.
Yes. That was the linkage
where it came in.
Okay.
Specifically Section 6.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. Where can you look someone up? How do you do that?
Co-Chair Nathanson, yes. Member of the committee, Representative Boone. It currently is managed through a process of qualified entities that register with the Department of Human Services. They go through specific background checks to be a qualified entity designee, who then can submit background checks, can check the registry, and that includes a good portion of these organizations and their members that can be running these background checks and look up the registry, see that somebody's there, and automatically progress with their next hiring stage.
And just a quick follow-up. You hear the term background checks in a lot of different sectors, and for example, child care workers, et cetera, and that there are levels of it, and you can do it through state police, et cetera, and they're all different prices and degrees of scrutiny. So is there a guideline there for a specific kind of care that they get this background check, or they start here and if something ticks they move up, or how does that work?
There are a variety of levels, all depending on the statute and the type of provider. As you mentioned, you know, child care and the like. So there, in addition to a variety of federal statutes that might assign various criminal history that would automatically affect someone, there's also various Oregon statutes that have been incorporated in that. And in terms of a more global background check, at least from the Department of Human Services side, you would also include abuse checks, all depending on the population, and that may differ from other state agencies that don't necessarily have access to that information. So once again, it can vary agency to agency.
And we've had quite a number of stories, including from one of the committee members, on how many background checks an individual person can go through.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask one thing?
Even though you've qualified at the highest level, got the cleanest record, all the other background checks by law, because we haven't straightened out our statutes and our processes yet, you still have to pay for and wait for approvals for multiple follow-up background checks as you volunteer at a school, as you become a foster parent, as you become a teacher or a healthcare provider, or any number of other professions. You go through multiple background checks. So that's what we're trying to straighten out here.
Okay. Just
pain that. Yes. Senator Winters.
Thank you. And Madam Co-Chair, we also haven't addressed the issue of the background checks and its usage, whether we're talking misdemeanors and what have you, because, you know, we get calls in our office that, you know, I really didn't create a felony, but yet, you know, I've been denied. And so you're correct. At some point, this body needs to have a good work group that looks at all those aspects. Mm-hmm. I think we've gone through this thing of not only all of the morphing of background checks to the point to where, one, the process of trying to get through, two, the process of denials, three, if we don't watch it, we're not going to have a workforce at all, because, you know, if I talk to ACLU, they will tell me that, you know, if I look at the number of men who have misdemeanors and everything else, you know, we're not going to allow you to work. So I think it behooves us as legislators to begin to address this issue of background checks and how it has proliferated all over the place, and see if we can't bring some sanity to some insanity.
I'm with the senator.
Thank you very much for this update. It's good news.
Thank you for the opportunity to present this report.
Glad to hear the progress.
Oh, forgive me. If the department requests acknowledgement of the receipt of this report.
Oh, okay. And we will take care of that at a subsequent meeting.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Well, I think committee got the thing.
Thank you all. We're adjourned.
I didn't see the report. Did you?
Thank you all. We're adjourned.
I didn't see the report. Did you?